Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Telecommunications and Electronic Media Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, July 25, 2017, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's teleforum conference call. This afternoon, we will explore the global politics of internet regulation, actors, and trajectory. My name is Laura Flint. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are happy to have with us Will Hudson, Senior Advisor for International Policy at Google, Patricia J. Paoletta, Partner at Wiltshire & Grannis, Sally Wentworth, Vice President of Global Policy Development at the Internet Society, and our moderator, Umair Javed, Associate at Wiley-Ryan. I'll turn it over to Umair to get us started. After opening remarks, we'll go to audience question and answer. Thank you for speaking with us. The floor is yours.
Thanks, Laura, and welcome everyone to today's forum on the global politics of internet regulation. My name is Umair Javed, and I'm honored to have with me today three true leaders in the field. First, Sally Wentworth, as Laura mentioned, is Vice President of Global Policy for the Internet Society, which is a global organization on the forefront of maintaining a free and open internet amidst some very significant challenges to that model, as we will discuss today. Prior to joining the Internet Society 8 years ago, Sally worked on internet policy issues at the White House and the U.S. Department of State. We also have with us Will Hudson, Senior Advisor for International Policy at Google, where he is responsible for internet governance matters, Google's relationship with international organizations like the United Nations, and other international policy issues. Before joining Google, Will was Director for International Cyber Policy at the National Security Council, and prior to that, he served in a variety of national security positions with the U.S. government. And finally, Tricia Paoletta, known to most, I'm sure, is a partner with the law firm of Harris, Wiltshire & Grannis, where she specializes in telecommunications and internet policy. Ms. Paoletta has accrued considerable experience in senior advisor roles to the International Bureau Chief at the FCC, as Director of Telecommunications Trade Policy in the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative, and as Majority Counsel to the House Energy and Commerce Committee. Thank you all again. So to set the stage for our speakers, there's been a lot of controversy in recent years over how decisions that shape the evolution and use of the internet should be made. And a number of recent events have taken these somewhat arcane questions and moved them into the public consciousness. These include disclosures about controversial U.S. surveillance practices, the U.S.'s decision to transition its stewardship of ICANN to a broader multi-stakeholder community, the prolonged internet outages in Syria during political turmoil, cybersecurity concerns after the elections and about denial of service attacks, the Great Firewall of China, and many others. And so these internet governance debates touch on a range of public policy issues, from freedom of expression, trade, privacy, security, even state sovereignty. For many years, the U.S. championed a role for all stakeholders in internet governance and pressed for a multi-stakeholder approach where national governments could participate on an equal footing with private sector, civil society, and academia. And this approach emphasized a universal freedom to connect and support for a free and open internet. But as the internet's global importance has grown over the last decade, perhaps not surprisingly, so too has the interest of some governments for a larger role. And so support is developing for an alternative model, one that asserts government sovereignty over the flow of information within their borders, and that favors intergovernmental arrangements, where states are the primary actors in policy discussions that are administered within the United Nations and within specifically the International Telecommunication Union, which is a body that we are going to discuss a little bit more today. This alternative model would produce very different results for the internet. And the common refrain behind this model is a lack of trust in U.S. leadership and in existing institutions. So the question that confronts both the government and industry today, I think, is that if there are benefits to the multi-stakeholder model, and I think there are, how do we make the case for it in 2017, especially if the case is no longer persuasive? Sally, perhaps we can start with you. You published a blog post just last week titled, "How Can We Expand the Use of the Multi-Stakeholder Model?" Perhaps you could give us a little bit of an overview of how the internet governance environment has worked, where have these debates come from, what the ITU is, and how it's connected to the issue of internet governance.
Sure. Thank you. And thanks for having me here. this is a big topic and one that has been with us for quite some time. And as you point out, I think it's gaining some momentum, this question of the role of government in the development of internet policy, and then the role of intergovernmental organizations like the ITU in the exercise of that role. How should governments work through the ITU to carry out policy objectives related to the internet? So if we look back to some of the earliest days of the internet, it is not a surprise to anybody, I think, that the internet developed and grew largely outside of the traditional regulatory processes. It began as a research project of the United States government through a series of decisions by the Clinton administration in the 90s. It transitioned into a private sector-led endeavor. And along with that, the technology developed largely in private sector hands. And there were a number of governance structures that emerged from that process to manage different aspects of the internet. So where coordination was needed to make these various networks speak to each other, because the internet is, I should say, a series of networks that choose to interconnect, there were some processes that were stood up to ensure that these networks could, in fact, speak to each other. So there was work that was done to manage the standards development for the internet. There was private sort of multi-stakeholder entities that were created to manage the domain name system, to manage IP addressing. And again, all of this developed because the idea was that the people building and using the network should figure out how these systems should work. It was not a government-defined system. At the same time this was happening, organizations like the ITU, which parenthetically have been around since the late 19th century, were still doing their work. They were still doing the work of telecommunications. They were working on the policies, the standards, the spectrum policy, et cetera, to interconnect telecommunications networks around the world. But as the internet continued to grow, there emerged this clash between this kind of bottom-up, free-formed way of doing business in the internet space and the more centralized, top-down approach of the traditional telecommunications environment. And that clash really played out and has been playing out in the ITU context for about 15, maybe even 20 years. I think the first real sign that we saw of this was in 2000 at a big ITU conference in Montreal, where there was a desire by countries to figure out if they could begin to tax in some way or put tariffs on data transmissions around the world. The same way that they were able to tariff international telephone calls, they wanted to see some sort of regime emerge where they could do that for data flows. That was not that has not been successful, but I should tell you that this is a desire that persists today, because of course, as the internet continues to grow, the traditional telecom traffic continues to decline. And so the revenues associated with that traffic also are declining for governments and industry around the world. And so this pressure is emerging on the internet environment to try to somehow behave as though it were like the telecom environment. And governments, as you said, are increasingly interested in the internet, and for reasonable reasons. There's a huge amount of their economy is being run over these networks. It's crucial increasingly to national security. There are issues related to the behavior of their own citizens. And so governments are very interested in the internet. They have a role to play. And the question that emerges is, what role and how should the government exercise that role over a technology that is inherently cross-border? It does not recognize traditional nation-state boundaries. It is a voluntary network of networks. And there's a whole governance system that has emerged that is not reliant upon government intervention. And so these are the questions and the challenges that I think are playing out in the ITU space, where governments operate by treaty. They're the ones who get to speak. Those of us who go to ITU meetings have to be recognized specially if we want to express our point of view. It is not a system set up to enable all stakeholders or interested parties to come together, but rather it's a intergovernmental body that allows some industry to pay to participate. And so this creates a lot of tensions. And I think those tensions are ever increasing as these issues, as you said, of internet, whether it's content or security or consumer protection or privacy or the Internet of Things, as all of those things emerge on the front pages of newspapers all over the world, governments are now bringing those issues to the ITU to try to find solutions to whatever problems, whether they're economic problems or national security problems or law enforcement or their own sort of political futures problems, right? As citizens can speak up against their governments using the internet, there's all this pressure coming into the ITU to be doing something. And I think the real difficulty with that is, number one, it's counter to the way the internet has grown and developed for decades now, which is more open and bottom-up and inclusive, but it also has a tendency to result in greater centralization and control. And that has difficulties from a technical perspective, because that means things get more brittle, they get less resilient, it's not good for security, but it also raises concerns about free speech, about human rights, and about the ability of the digital economy to prosper when more and more gateways of control are put in place. So that's a very quick overview. I think it's quick. Is there anything else you would like me to address in my comments?
Thanks, Sally. That was very helpful. You raised, a concern from a number of governments over how the internet is developing and their ability to influence that process. What is the U.S. government's position on this? Are they seeking protection of the status quo? What is a good outcome for the U.S. government when these governments come to the ITU with these concerns?
Well, I think the U.S. government's longstanding position has been to support the growth of the internet as a private sector, multi-stakeholder-led endeavor, and to try to encourage a more open and inclusive process to manage its development. That has been the longstanding position of the United States government. Now, of course, the United States has a lot of interest in organizations like the ITU that go beyond the internet. So the U.S. has deep interest in issues related to spectrum, issues related to international cooperation in general on communications matters. And so what that means is that when the U.S. goes to an ITU conference, it has core principles, but it tries to reach consensus, because I think in the end, at least for now, the U.S. government still wants to see an ITU that it can work within and get things done. So I think what I've seen the U.S. do is try to open conversations, try to push the ITU to be more inclusive, more open to other stakeholders, hold the line on the scope of the ITU. So the ITU has a specific scope and mandate, and not allow that to grow, to include issues related to internet content or internet governance or internet management of resources, while at the same time upholding its general commitments to international cooperation and those principles.
And the U.S. has responded to some extent to government's concerns. It relinquished its stewardship role over ICANN. What's next for ICANN now that it's out from under U.S. oversight? Is there a fear that some countries that are still unhappy with U.S. influence will push for even more changes, like moving ICANN out of California? What do you think about that?
So as you said, the U.S. has continued down its path of supporting the multi-stakeholder model and taken that to the extent that it relinquished its oversight role of the IANA functions and transitioned those to the multi-stakeholder community. As part of that, there were a number of structural changes to ICANN to help ensure that it was both transparent and inclusive and sustainable enough to do the work that needed to be done to in terms of its role with the IANA functions. There are some countries, as you said, that are not necessarily pleased with this outcome, that they would like to see a greater role for the ITU or for governments in general in providing oversight. I think it's our view that the legal questions with respect to the IANA transition are largely settled, that the transition to ICANN is firmly in place. There are conversations that will continue to happen to ensure ICANN remains responsive to its community. But I think what we will see and continue to see in the ITU environment is a push for governments to have a greater and greater say in how critical internet resources are managed, whether those are domain names or IP addresses or even the standards themselves. And also a greater degree of oversight in how technology itself unfolds. So things like the Internet of Things, trying to provide regulatory frameworks. They're even talking about artificial intelligence over there at the ITU. So the appetite for government engagement seems to have no bounds. And I think that that will be a continued point of tension within the ITU.
Thank you very much. Will, in many ways, Google is at the forefront of these policy debates. It's fighting for increased openness and connectivity around the world, even in countries like North Korea, Afghanistan, Pakistan. When we talked before today's calls, you noted that it might be tempting to get caught up in kind of the overarching principles and the policy debates about multi-stakeholder versus multilateral. But what are the real-world threats that private businesses are facing from ITU activity in the internet space, and what can or should the U.S. be doing in the face of those threats?
Great, thanks, Amira, and I agree with what Sally said just to begin, and I think that, you know, as we and other businesses look at the policy landscape internationally right now, I think one thing is abundantly clear, which is that, you know, the internet as it exists today is going to be changing in one way or another. And, you know, we can sort of look at one future where we have more authoritarian, repressive regimes that are increasingly interested in creating their own closed networks for others to join. And what this would mean in practice is that, you know, the people in those countries would be shut off from the global platform that, you know, we've come to enjoy for commerce, for free expression, and for lots of other things that we've collectively come to experience as the internet, you know, quote unquote. The other option is, of course, that we keep the governments out of the business of running the internet, and we let the innovators who built this engine of the 21st century economy continue to play that role. I think it's no surprise that we come down on the latter side, that, you know, innovators, entrepreneurs, members of civil society, technical experts, individual users, you know, the people that built the internet and made it what it is today should be the ones that are continuing to drive its success. And I think that, you know, we get wrapped up in terms, you know, multi-stakeholder, multilateral, and these are important concepts, and I'm sure we'll talk more about them today, but for us, it's sort of that core truth. That's what we're talking about here. Should governments be in the business of regulating the experience of the internet, or should the people that have made it what it is today continue to have that role? And frankly, to your point about expanding connectivity, I think that's one of the challenges there, that, you know, we want more and more people to get online for lots of reasons. But one of those reasons is that we want, you know, this global platform to be more and more participatory. And I think that, you know, this seems like an obvious issue, and I'm often talking with folks and they sort of scratch their heads and say, you know, why is this even an issue? And as Sally alluded to, I mean, I think it's very simple that, you know, some countries are afraid of what the internet is and what it means. And, you know, Freedom House does this amazing annual assessment and goes on a country-by-country basis that looks at how free and open the internet is around the world. And one of the conclusions, you know, I think you're left with, and anyone is left with after reading that report, is that there isn't just a, you know, quote-unquote open internet and a quote-unquote closed internet. There's, you know, in fact, incredible variety and variation on whether and to what extent government takes steps to limit online expression, to limit access to information, to limit cross-border data flows, to limit the things that make the internet what it is. And there are a huge swath of countries in between those two poles that are looking for guidance. They don't have the bureaucracies that some countries have. They don't have some of the experience or the history dealing with these things in the way that, you know, we sometimes take for granted. And so they're looking for guidance, given some of the very real concerns that Sally alluded to before. So, you know, from us and from a business perspective, what that means is that we can't stand still and just hope that the rest of the world decides that the internet isn't that big of a deal. Those days are long gone. And Amer, as you alluded to at the beginning, I think, you know, the U.S. has traditionally taken a very strong leadership role in this, not just fighting for principles, but fighting to put those principles into action at the international level. You know, you referenced the IANA transition last year, which for us was an important way, not just of sort of responding to concerns by other government, but, you know, quite the opposite. The U.S. showing leadership itself, showing that it was committed to the idea that the free and open internet, you know, should be run in a certain way and not as others would contest in a different way. So, you know, with that in mind, very briefly, I thought I'd touch on two things, two areas where governments are trying to regulate the internet. First, as Sally spoke to a little bit, there's a UN specialized agency called the International Telecommunication Union, or ITU. It's based in Geneva. It does a lot of good things. I think this is important, you know, because from industry's perspective, I think it's incredibly valuable work on things like ready-use spectrum allocation. I think there's often this narrative that, you know, the ITU is engaging in some sort of activity that, you know, we're critical of, but that detracts from the fact that it does do some really important work on radio spectrum allocation, you know, satellites, this type of stuff, where if the ITU didn't exist, we'd have to go and create another organization to do those kinds of activities. That said, some governments are pushing the ITU to do more and to move beyond its sort of traditional, you know, embedded in treaty scope of working on international telecommunications networks and to instead start regulating the internet itself. So by way of example, and we can talk more about other examples later, you know, this year we've seen proposals for the ITU to do things like develop regulatory frameworks for online service providers, which at this point, importantly, don't just include companies like Google, but include content providers, include lots of small and medium businesses, include increasingly diversified producers of equipment like refrigerators or other things that have Wi-Fi connectivity in them. And these regulatory pushes are based on the premise that, you know, there are security concerns and that the online services are harmful to the revenue and health of network operators. Sally talked about this a little bit. You know, I take issue with that characterization. There was one recent study that showed that, in fact, just by working more closely together, by network operators and online providers working more closely together, in EMEA alone, in Europe, the Middle East, and Africa, that would improve cash flows to those network operators by upwards of 15 billion euros by 2021. So the value of partnership is there. It's a question of, you know, are we going to seize on that? Or are we going to sort of go down this path of regulating something because it's different? It's not just at the ITU, though. We're also seeing an effort to regulate the internet at national levels. South Asia is a particularly vibrant example of this. You know, in Thailand, we've seen an effort to regulate online video services and compel foreign providers to establish a local presence. In practice, these kinds of proposals are indicative of a broader trend we're seeing around the world, and that's one of data localization. And, you know, we can talk about this for hours, but the concern here is fundamentally that the internet is a cross-border beast, and that if the internet's broken up because governments mandate where data may be stored or processed, then all the economic security and other benefits of the internet will be diminished, if not completely destroyed. You know, we can talk about some of the reasons why governments are pushing for that, and why we at least think that they're based on sort of false premises. But rather than continue to talk, I thought I'd shut up and let others talk, or you ask me questions.
Sure. Well, let me ask one question. So one central criticism of the multi-stakeholder model is that it isn't representative enough, and that it's dominated by U.S. and Western interests at the expense of some emerging economies. In many cases, these emerging economies make up a very fast-growing share of the internet population. Now, you mentioned some of the concerns of these countries, how they might be caught in the middle, but how do you respond to that criticism? Is this an issue of just educating these countries on how to appropriately benefit from the internet, or is there something deeper?
Well, I mean, I think it's any number of things. I mean, I think, first of all, the more people that show up and can take an active role in governing this fundamentally global thing, the better. The more we do that, the better off the networks are, and our governance of those networks is. You know, that said, at a recent ICANN meeting in Johannesburg, there was an effort to, boost participation from local governments by sort of explaining how they can get involved in this process. You know, Google and some other companies are fortunate that we have. Robust policy offices, and so there's people like me that can look at these issues day in, day out. And for many other businesses, not just in emerging markets, but in the U.S. or Silicon Valley itself, that's difficult. And so I think that one of the things we try and do is explain at a very practical level, how you can get engaged, how it doesn't need to be showing up at these three international conferences every year, plus many more, that there's remote participation options, that there's common period options, that there's trade and industry association groups, that there's members of civil society, there's technical community folks that are all looking at these issues and can be a force multiplier. It's just a matter of knowing what's important to individual people so that those groups are in fact representative. So that's one of the things we care very deeply about. I know many others do too. So we've got room to grow, but I think that there's that effort is underway as we speak.
Perfect. Tricia, both Sally and Will have noted that the ITU is doing some very good and some very important work, and you've been very deep in that work. Sally noted that the ITU has been around for a very long time, almost 100 years. Even though it's a specialized agency of the UN, it actually predates that body, which is interesting in itself. But what is the ITU and specifically its radio communication sector doing that is helpful in facilitating internet access? How effective has the U.S. been in advancing its interests on the spectrum and technical side? And are there lessons that can be learned for pushing back against some of the more controversial activities that we've been hearing about?
Thank you, Ymir. And, to put this in context, right, the ITU is actually 150 years plus. Yeah, it recently celebrated its 150th anniversary. And, it started off, it was not called the International Telecommunications Union at that point, but it started off because France and Germany wanted to have a telegraph line that was going to cross the border. So they needed a forum for these two governments to come together and speak. And, in Europe, the boundaries of countries are much smaller. So, telecommunications from its nascent telegraph and then, submarine cable days was inherently international. And as telecom companies began to spring up. They didn't spring up because they were highly capital intensive, right? So they were typically government initiatives because the capital costs were so high. And even in the U.S., we had a brief year of misguided policy where our own U.S. government had nationalized the American telegraph and telephone, let me say that again, American Telegraph and Telephone Company for about a year. That's our current AT&T. So, you know, you had government involvement from the earliest days of telecommunications. So the ITU grew out of that required forum for countries to sit down and talk about, well, gosh, if we're going to, you know, lay this line here and we have to make sure it's receptive on your end and our end. So it was a standard-setting body in the earliest days. Now, as both, I think, Sally and Will alluded to, now you have private sector standards bodies that are really doing the real work. You have IETF, you know, for the internet space. You have IEEE, you know, lots of other ones. But, you know, the ITU started being the forum, so it's hard to let go. And as we see in the U.S., right, any government function, you know, has mission creep over the years. So now, as Sally had suggested, you know, now they're trying to get into whatever is relevant in the world. So artificial intelligence, they're trying to get involved in Internet of Things. Now, you asked, Umair, you know, what is the work the ITU does in radio communications? The ITU is structured in three different bureaus or sectors. So you have the telecommunications sector, and that has been where standardization, you know, back from the earliest, you know, 150 years ago of telegraph, you know, standards down to today, although I'd argue with very few exceptions, they're not doing anything original in technical standards for telecommunications or certainly, you know, the internet. They have branched out, and we can talk about this if Will and Sally want to later. They have branched out to modern technologies like cloud security and all manner of things, but again, those tend to be really referential to work that's being done by the private sector in, you know, telecommunications and, you know, technology standardization bodies. So there's the telecommunications sector, there's the development sector, and that's the sector where, in particular, emerging markets, developing countries are active, and along with the developed sectors and developed countries, you know, to basically do a form of technology transfer and, you know, to develop recommendations that countries can use to promote economies of scale and scope. And because it's development, it you know, is ranges across the different sectors in terms of, you know, both terrestrial wireline technologies as well as spectrum. And then finally, there's the radio communications sector. And that sector, of course, deals with spectrum management. And, you know, that's an inherently, particularly if you're in Europe, right, an international enterprise because those, you know, radio waves, air, you know, they don't stop at the border, right? They, you know, the spectrum is all around us. And obviously the technology has learned to channel different bands of spectrum and where they are in the frequency range. But because that, you know, that, you absolutely do need some sort of regulation in that space. I mean, I think if we were to do it all over again with the benefit of current technology, we'd say the private sector can do a lot of that regulation. But again, traditionally, that was done by governments because the concern of a radio device operating in one band of spectrum might cause interference to another device if you didn't have, you know, harmonized allocations for different devices. You know, now we've got a lot more technology and cognitive intelligence in devices, and, you know, they can sense and avoid and, you know, see if the channel's available, all that good stuff. But, you know, again, back in the historic perspective, you needed, you know, regulation to determine where we were going to allocate, you know, particular services, you know, for particular bands. And that raises the governmental interest, as Sally alluded to. You know, the U.S. government, you know, we're in a continental size country, but we obviously have facilities overseas and, you know, well, over our Pacific Ocean in Hawaii, and we've got, you know, of course, allies around the world. You know, DOD will tell you they're a global operator. You know, FAA has interests in ensuring that, you know, globally, you know, planes are flying safely and planes coming into the U.S. are on the right radio frequency channels for their, you know, for their traffic and telemetry controls. So, you know, across the board, right, the U.S. government has an interest in internationally harmonized spectrum for government functions. And, you know, the industry has an interest in that as well because, you know, if there's global harmonization in, you know, say certain bands for mobile broadband or satellite, as Will mentioned, well, then, you know, U.S. manufacturers of equipment and devices and chips and, you know, the Apples of the world, you know, what have you, can then address a global market. And that, of course, benefits U.S. consumers because they get the global ecosystem of devices. And so, you know, so there are positive benefits for the ITU radio communications sector for both industry and for government. But the, you know, it's hard to translate lessons learned in that space to lessons learned in the other spaces because I think unlike perhaps the content and internet governance issues that are skirting around T, you know, everybody who comes to Geneva, you know, for radio communications, you know, whether they support open internet principles and, you know, freedom of expression online and elsewhere, you know, everybody is coming to Geneva with the goal that, okay, we have to have harmonized allocations so our operations work when we want to, you know, operate and we don't suffer our people, our devices, our systems, whether they're government or private sector, won't suffer interference from non-compliant, you know, systems. So everybody shares that goal, which is, I think, very different from what we're hearing from, you know, Will and Sally, from, you know, sort of the content and the control issues on the T side. So they're not exactly transferable lessons, unfortunately. But, you know, but it also underlines a, you know, kind of a more fundamental issue. You can't just, you know, there's been you know, movements over the years to say, let's just not fund the ITU, let's pull out of the ITU, let's not be involved in the ITU. But because you do have that affirmative interest, both by government and industry, in the radio communication side and in the, you know, safety and economic benefits of harmonized spectrum allocations, you know, that the U.S. will always need to go there, as, you know, as Will said. If we didn't have that body, we would have to create it. Unfortunately, you know, simultaneously, we face a containment challenge with the T side, where they do want to expand into control and you know, into the internet, because that is, you know, from their perspective, well, from many countries' perspectives, right? You know, that is a government function. I mean, well, let's put this data point out there for our listeners. Currently, the ITU is chaired by a Chinese engineer, Zhao Hulin. He's Chinese. He had a background in government. The Chinese operators for telecommunications are all, you know, come out of government ownership or have substantial ownership, you know, by their government. So for them, you know, a government role is certainly a natural experience for them. So you know, I think even at the leadership of the ITU, you do have that challenge where, you know, with the Chinese Secretary General coming from, you know, that kind of background, it seems perfectly natural that the ITU would expand where internet technology and the industry is going, into Internet of Things and into artificial intelligence. So, you know, fundamentally we have, you know, and China is obviously not the only issue, not the only country that has come with a strong government ownership in the actual operators, let alone a strong government role in, you know, network planning policies and content, what have you. But so we have those challenges to manage. And unfortunately, while the ITUR is important for the U.S., you know, that it's a different sector than the other two different, you know, than the telecommunications sector.
Thanks, Tricia. And I'm glad you noted the recent calls, well, maybe not recent, but the fact that there have been some who have suggested that, well, maybe if the U.S. is not getting good results at the ITU, we should just take our ball and go home. You know, in the past couple of years, we have seen some countries increase their participation at the ITU, both in the sense of their financial contribution and in the sense of seeking out leadership positions at the ITU. At that same time, we've heard calls that the U.S. should reduce its participation. Do you see that as a challenge? Do you see increased participation by certain countries, namely China, Russia, some of the Arab countries, as creating more issues in the R sector? And what are your thoughts on whether the U.S. Should maintain, increase, or decrease its role?
Well, yeah, I do think it creates issues and challenges for us, and I think the U.S. does need to match their involvement with our involvement. You know, back on the expensiveness, I suppose, of emerging countries being active. You know, now the ICANN meetings are not in Geneva; they're various places, but certainly in Geneva. Geneva is one of the most expensive cities in the world, if not the most expensive city. And yeah, so that's very challenging for the emerging countries to show up. And in the R sector, radio communications sector, you have various working parties and study groups, and under the study groups you have working parties, and it's rare to see many African delegates there, many delegates from South America or the Caribbean, because it is so expensive to attend meetings in Geneva. So that, I mean, that's kind of a challenge. So in that, you know, and traditionally, we might not have time to explore all this on our call, but traditionally each of the regions, and this is including for the United States, works through a regional body. In the United States, we work through our regional body. It's a subcommittee of the Organization of American States called the International Committee for Telecommunications, or CITEL, C-I-T-E-L in the acronym. You know, and traditionally we're stronger if we can show up in Geneva with our region behind us, with CITEL behind us. But there are challenges if you show up in Geneva and it's just the United States and maybe Canada, right? Mexico, maybe, but not the, you know, rest of Brazil, but not the whole region. So there, you know, we certainly have to keep trying to show equal presence relative to some of the other regions that don't share our views on internet governance and on freedom of speech. But, currently is a challenge, I think, in this administration, and we'll have to see how it plays out with the State Department budget being proposed by this administration for, you know, steep cuts, and without political appointees at the State Department for that kind of leadership that, you know, Will and Sally had mentioned. So we have a number of challenges, but certainly keeping our participation comparable to countries that have very different views of freedom of expression is something we should strive to do.
Well, thank you again. Thank you to all our speakers. I would like to give our listeners an opportunity to engage and ask questions. Laura, could you open up the bridge?
Let's go to audience questions. In a moment, you will hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Not seeing any questions yet, I'll make a brief announcement. Our next Teleform conference call is scheduled for tomorrow, Wednesday, July 26th at 2 p.m. That call will be on Lee v. U.S. and the recent Supreme Court decision on ineffective counsel, and will feature Brian R. Frizzell, appellate counsel at the Constitutional Accountability Center, and Laura Howell, assistant attorney general at the Alabama Attorney General's Office, both of whom wrote amicus briefs for the case. Reminder to keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming Teleform calls and to consult the full schedule of our upcoming calls on the Federalist Society's website, fedsoc.org. Also available there are podcasts of previously recorded Teleform calls you may have missed. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Not seeing any audience questions, Umera, do you have any other questions for our speakers?
Sure. Well, while we are waiting for our first question, let me give Will and Sally an opportunity to answer, to share their thoughts on that last question. There seems to be a tension here. We're facing challenges at the ITU. If the U.S. stays involved at the ITU, it seems we give some legitimacy to the debates that are occurring there. If the U.S. reduces its participation, it seems we lose our opportunity to play defense and stop the more troubling proposals. Do either of you have thoughts on this? What's the right path for the U.S.?
So I'll chime in quickly. I think, you know, I'm a big believer, you know, that, you know, you have to show up to change the outcome. And so I think that, you know, the question is sort of as Tricia was speaking to, what are we trying to accomplish in doing so? And so I think that, you know, as the United States considers, particularly in, you know, in light of some of the changes going on at the State Department, I think the primary consideration needs to not be in terms of, you know, the first question shouldn't be which meetings are we showing up to, you know, what are the consensus positions or whatever. But I think that the first question for the United States needs to be the same question that any government asks, which is, you know, what do we seek to accomplish out of this group? What are we seeking to do in a holistic sense, and then work backwards from that? And so I think that, you know, now is a great time, you know, with new leadership and, you know, the budget considerations notwithstanding, should force some new conversations about what we want to do at the ITU. And so I think industry would encourage and welcome that kind of discussion. But for us, it's important that we know where we're swimming, and then we can deal with all the individual substantive issues, you know, consistent with that overarching framework. But we need to know that first question, the answer to the first question.
Just to jump in as well, I like Will's formulation. If you want to have an impact, you have to show up. I think while it might be temporarily satisfying to take our balls and go home, I think there are a couple realities. First, the ITU the membership of the ITU is making decisions that will have implications for the United States, as Will noted, for U.S. industry, Tricia noted, for spectrum and wireless communications around the globe. That those decisions will be made, and the U.S. has to decide whether it wants to influence those decisions or not. And, you know, from where we sit at the Internet Society, it's not my job to you know, tell the U.S. what its position should be. But the U.S. has a long history of being a leader and a voice for an open and free Internet around the world. And we would certainly hope and look for the United States to continue being that voice, even when it's hard. Even when the deck seems stacked against that message, I still think it matters that the United States is there to deliver that message along with other allies around the world. So I think we would like to see and hope that the U.S. continues to be an active voice for these issues at the ITU and elsewhere. In terms of effectiveness, I think the U.S. is effective when it's clear and it knows what it's trying to achieve and it is upfront with the world about its objectives. And when that happens, the U.S., you know, it's not going to win everything, nor should it, but it can be part of the conversation and an effective part. So I think that the conversation about, you know, walking out or whatever is, like I said, it can be satisfying in the moment. But if you want to shape the direction of the ITU or any other institution, you have to be there to do it.
Great. Laura, unless there's an audience question, I'll ask one final question and I'll open it up to all of the speakers. But in the midst of all of these debates, it's easy to forget that internet governance is being carried out operationally in various venues and institutions and in the private sector. So I'd be interested to hear, so maybe this is two questions. One, what are the ITU meetings and events that are upcoming that are on your radar? And two, what are the non-ITU fora where these debates are happening and where it's important to participate?
I'll jump in first just on the plenipotentiary meeting that will be in 2018. Because I mentioned there were the three sectors, right, development, telecommunications, and radio communications. And each of those different sectors have their own conference every, you know, multiple years. In the radio communications side, it's the World Radio Communication Conference. And that next one is 2019, and people are actively working on that for more spectrum for, you know, mobile broadband, for satellites, for aerial, broadband, all manner of issues. But all the different sectors have their plenipotentiary meeting in 2018, and there we'll have some core decisions made. And I'll pause there because Will and Sally understand more on what issues might be teed up on the T side, as well as the Internet Governance Forum and other fora for talking about IANA and some of the other issues. So Will or Sally?
I can jump in. As Tricia said, each part of the ITU has a conference roughly every 4 years to kind of manage its own work. And so there's one coming up in October in Buenos Aires, Argentina. This is the World Telecom Development Conference. As the name indicates, it will be about development-related issues. But it's increasingly difficult to separate out a range of general communications issues from development issues. So we can expect a host of regulatory topics, security-related issues, all of those to come up. I think if you go outside the ITU, there's quite a lot happening. Within the UN, there's a global group of experts looking at cybersecurity, where proposals are coming up for do we need a new international treaty to govern the behavior of nation states in cyberspace? As more and more attacks hit the front pages of the papers, I think we should expect momentum to build towards some sort of norm setting or rules of the road in this regard. And there's a number of groups out there looking at what would be the norms or the expectations of different actors during cyber conflict. There's a global conference on security in cyberspace that's supposed to happen later this year in New Delhi, India, that will also raise issues of security. And so the security landscape right now is full of negotiations and dialogues happening that I think will culminate at some point into, as Will said, some sort of, I don't know if it's restructuring, but clarity on who's supposed to do what and what are the reactions to these increasing threats. Will, anything you want to add? I didn't put IGF, so I guess I left that to you.
Thanks. Yeah, so there's also something called the Internet Governance Forum, which is an annual global meeting that, in contrast to some of the other forums we're talking about today, doesn't produce an outcome document. There's not a negotiated text at the end of it. And so, a lot of people scratch their heads and say, why should I show up for a week to talk? And the answer to that is it makes the conversation at all these other treaty making conferences and negotiated outcome document meetings easier because governments, business, civil society sort of unfettered by the, where the commas are going to get placed in the outcome document are able to have, in my experience, very frank and good conversations about, not just these kinds of questions, but, violent extremism online, how to make the internet more participatory and these kinds of things. And so I think that, that is an important meeting. But for, for all the meetings that Tricia and Sally mentioned, I think for us, the important thing as business is making sure that there is a voice in the room. We're not going to change the rules at the UN First Committee to have a multi-stakeholder decision-making process there. But what we can do is show as industry and as civil society and technical community, and so forth, that we're committed to good outcomes and we can be reasonable and constructive players in an existing multilateral framework, while at the same time continuing to try and push more and more decisions about how the networks are themselves governed and the cross-border nature of this stuff into a more participatory multi-stakeholder process whenever we can. And so I think that, it behooves us to sort of recognize where we are, but continue to push forward because it's in the best interest of the internet and frankly, everyone that uses it.
I'll make a final call for audience questions. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Not seeing any. Would anybody like to make some closing remarks?
Well, I'll just say once again a very big thank you to all of our speakers for what I hope was a very interesting and enlightening conversation. Thank you again.
Thank you.
On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this practice group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.